Hello, and joining you in the first week of November. I shan't be more specific than that because the actual release date of this podcast is as closely guarded a secret as Tadej Pogacar's 2026 race program. My name's Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this decidedly low-key, dare I say, slightly ad hoc episode of the Cycling Podcast in which we will try to shovel a few last embers of lukewarm topics and reheated news stories into the end of season furnace. Joining me to do that with his oven gloves on is Lionel Burney. Have I whipped up enough excitement, Lionel?
Oh, you've oversold it, if anything.
Yeah. But it is that time of year, isn't it? Everything is sort of dying down, or, well, if you're a professional rider, you are probably sodding off on holiday. That's if you're not still looking for a contract, because a lot is still to be decided and signed, isn't it? And that's one of the topics we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, there's lots of uncertainty, but some riders will be starting all over again, won't they? Early November, their first sort of orientation camps, the first meet-up to set objectives for 2026. Come on, guys, it's only just finished. I saw Wout van Aert on social media talking about, well, he was posting pictures of his holiday with his family. I think they went to Italy, didn't they? And there were some quotes in the Belgian press, him saying just how much he needed a proper end of season holiday, because he sort of postponed slash curtailed his holiday at the end of last season, so he felt like it was long overdue, some proper downtime with his family before, well, they all head off to volcanoes again to start training for the 2026 season. Wout van Aert, of course, will be racing cyclocross in the not too distant future. He and Matthew van der Poel are expected to race in the cyclocross over the winter. I can see, Daniel, you're exhaling.
Lionel, the old cyclocross has kicked off already, hasn't it? I noticed that. Well, it kicked off a few weeks ago, in fact. But the Koppenberg cross, that's relatively important, isn't it? If I'm not mistaken, in the cyclocross world. There was some beef at the weekend, and before we recorded today, I asked you with the very vague grasp I clearly had of what had happened with Thibaut Ney. Something happened with him.
Yeah, well, I've now watched both races, Daniel. Yeah, the Koppenberg Cross is always held on November the 1st, no matter what day of the week that falls on. So it fell on a Saturday this year. It's probably one of the most spectator-friendly events because it takes place on a circuit on the side of the hill on the Koppenberg climb, famous, of course, for its starring role in the Tour of Flanders, the cobbled hill, very steep.
Infamous. This is the one that's infamous because it was the scene of the only sort of verified in kind of elite racing, although it was junior racing, case of motor doping, wasn't it? A few years ago. Femke van den Driessche, Lionel. This was where it happened in 2016.
I thought you were going to say infamous for the incident in the Tour of Flanders many years ago now in the 80s when Jesper Skibbu, the Danish rider, was out in front and he was being caught by the peloton and he came to a halt on the climb, and because there was nowhere for the race director's vehicle to go by, the race director basically rode over his two wheels and kind of left Skibbu with a broken bike. And, well, they took the Koppenberg out of the Tour of Flanders after that for quite a number of years. Anyway, we're diverting into all sorts of...
This is mainly going to be the digression cast, isn't it?
The digression cast, yeah. Well, Thibaut Ney, he won the Koppenberg Cross on Saturday ahead of Scotland's Cameron Mason. And as you will know, Daniel, Nace is the reigning European champion, the son of Sven Nace, of course, the great Belgian cyclocross rider who probably should have won more world titles than he actually did, given his dominance at the sort of next tier down of events. He was the big figure in cyclocross. Thibaut Nace is aiming to become the big figure of cyclocross, but of course he's racing a full season of cross, or more or less, and we'll look forward to seeing how he goes when Van Aert and Van der Poel do make their debuts, which will be quite a bit later on in the season. I think Van Aert made his debut around Christmas time last year. I expect that to be about the same this. Van der Poel may make an appearance slightly before that. We shall have to wait and see. Neither of them have released their schedules yet.
Lionel, I've got a question. One thing I did notice, I saw photos of T-Bone Nace at the weekend, and he doesn't wear a Little Trek jersey when he's doing the muddy thing.
He doesn't, and that is because he rides for a different team in the cyclocross, and I'm going to get it wrong. It's something like the Balois Lions.
Yeah, interesting, because of course now, I haven't got this wrong, have I? Now, as of this year, or maybe does it start next year? I think it starts on January the 1st, actually. Points in other disciplines are going to count towards a team's total in the World Tour, for example. I don't imagine that Little Trek will be in danger of relegation at the end of the next cycle, three-year cycle, but who knows? Those points could come in useful. I don't know if they've got any plans for him to join or to be representing Little Trek in cyclocross from January the 1st. Probably not.
Well, it's the Balois Glowy Lions, and, well, they're a pretty strong lineup because Nace is joined in that team by Pim Ronhar, who was third in the Koppenberg Cross, and Lars van der Haar, a seasoned cyclocross rider. Anyway, the difficulty that Nace had on Sunday that you alluded to, he had all manner of problems in the X2O Badcammers trophy race. X2O Badcammers, Daniel, you're shaking your head. It's a foreign language to you, isn't it? But that is a chain of bathroom supplies in Belgium, and they sponsor the cyclocross trophy, and the race was in Lokeren, and Nace had all kinds of problems, mechanical trouble. He swapped his bike, his handlebars were not to his liking, his saddle was too low, he was on and off the bike multiple times. I think only finished 15th, so a mixed weekend for Nace, but he will have his eyes on retaining the European title this coming weekend. But we should get out of the mud here, Daniel, and go through our sort of lucky dip of news.
I think we're going to have a short commercial interlude in a moment. But before we do, Lionel, just lest I forget, because I probably will forget, they're no longer a sponsor, but they were a long-time sponsor, Science in Sport, and a gentleman, he used to be the CEO, didn't he, Stephen Moon? Stephen Moon of SIS ran the New York Marathon yesterday, completed it. I only know Stephen's age because one of his friends posted it on Instagram in their message of congratulations. But Stephen is in his 60s, I'll say, late 60s. So great achievement. Well done, Stephen, if you're listening. I'm reminded of this as well because I've got a packet of SIS products sitting on my table at the moment. Anyway, there we go.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Before we continue, Daniel, and as we've reached the end of the road racing season, we wanted to say a huge thank you to all of our Friends of the Podcast subscribers for continuing to support us this year. We've been running the Friends of the Podcast subscriptions for more than a decade now, and it's no exaggeration to say that the cycling podcast simply wouldn't be here today without all of that support. Every single one of you, whether you've supported us since the very beginning, as I know a lot of you have, or just for a year or two along the way, that support is massively appreciated by us. Around about 12 to 15% of our regular audience chooses to support us financially by taking out a friend subscription. And that might sound like quite a small proportion of our listeners, But I can assure you that that support is absolutely vital to us. And without it, we wouldn't be able to go to the Giro, the Tour de France Femme and the Vuelta to cover the races on the ground, which is really the thing that makes the cycling podcast what it is. So a big, big thank you to everybody who has supported us. This year, we've made just over 30 episodes of Kilometre Zero. Starting back in January, I went to the Challenge Mallorca to make Nevermind the Baleariacs. Then there was a series of episodes that Daniel made at the Giro and the ones that Graham and I did at the Tour de France, as well as the unforgettable Kurowitz Corner and my interview with Jonathan Vaughters in the summer. Now, we decided to make almost half of those episodes available for everyone to listen to on our free feed, with the rest on the Friends of the Podcast feed. And that's because although the revenue is vital to us, we also wanted as many people as possible to listen to the episodes. So I hope that all of our listeners who've enjoyed those episodes on the free feed will be happy to join us in saying a big thank you to our biggest sponsors and supporters, our Friends of the Podcast, who play such a huge part in keeping the show on the road. Thank you. I hope you enjoy the end of season episodes and look forward to following the sport in 2026 with the Cycling Podcast. I think, is that the end of the commercial messages, Daniel?
Well, Lionel, what was the old Science in Sport discount code?
It was SISCP25. Daniel, I was going to say, rather tongue-in-cheek, that's the most you've said about Science in Sport in one episode than in the whole 7 years that they were our partners.
Now I'm endorsing their products.
You're a natural.
Now I'm endorsing their products. Yeah, I'll be using their products at the weekend.
What are you doing at the weekend?
Oh, I've got a big... this is my big objective of the season, Lionel. No, I've got a big race in Italy, actually, in the mountains in Italy. Valtellina. It's not a big race. It's a race.
Running.
Yeah, it's running. Trail running. Anyway, enough about that, Lionel. We are going to dip now into the sort of broader newsette of things that have been happening over the last not just few days but a couple of weeks, few things we've missed because the news cycle keeps on whirring. And at the start of today's episode, we touched on the fact that some riders and teams are not entirely sure of their plans for 2026 yet. Some riders are not even sure whether they've got contracts or teams for 2026 yet. And there has been some reporting, a bit of information on that in the last few days, hasn't there? Particularly regarding well-established World Tour teams. Lotto, well, they haven't been in the World Tour the last few years, but they're coming back into it. Intermarché, we know that those two teams have been plotting a merger for a while, still hasn't come to fruition. And then there's been more sort of worrying news, was a bit of worrying news, followed by a bit of relief about Jayco Alula.
Yeah, well, let's deal with Jayco Alula first, because listeners may know that each year the UCI sets a deadline by which all of the kind of paperwork has to be put in place and lodged with the governing body ahead of the following season. And that deadline was in the middle of October. And Jayco Alula didn't meet that deadline. And there was a kind of a period of a week or two where there was a bit of uncertainty about what was going on. And it appears that it was because the bank guarantee for the coming season had not been lodged by the Jayco Alula team. Now, this is roughly calculated as 25% of the total staff budget, isn't it? Riders and staff. And that money has to be basically lodged with the UCI, or it has to be proven that that money is safe and secure so that the team can be awarded its license for...
Proven. I believe it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be passed over to the UCI.
No, that's right. You have to demonstrate on paper with verified documents that that money is in existence. Now, quite surprising with this, really, because obviously the Jayco Alula is a very well-established team. It's been around since 2012, when it started out as the Orica Green Edge team, sponsored by the Orica Mining Company. And Green Edge was kind of the umbrella term that is still thought of as the Green Edge organization that kind of runs the team. And it's really been a passion project of Jerry Ryan, a very wealthy Australian businessman, a sports fanatic, massive sports fan. He's been involved in sports for decades, cycling one of his biggest passions, but also interested in horse racing. One of his horses won the Melbourne Cup, which I believe is the big deal in horse racing down under. I'm not really a horse racing kind of guy, but Melbourne Cup sounds good, doesn't it? He's also been involved in rugby league clubs in Australia, Australian rules, women's basketball, and his involvement in cycling goes back a long time, back to 1992, when he helped to fund Cathy Watt's participation for Australia in the Barcelona Olympics. Now, back then, the Australian Institute of Sport, I think, was just in its kind of infancy and quite still expensive for athletes based in Australia to compete on the world stage. Gerry Ryan, as a keen follower of cycling, helped to fund Cathy Watt's participation in the Olympics, and she won the road race in 92 for Australia and got a silver in the pursuit on the track as well. And the Australian his vision was always to have a world-class team competing in the Tour de France, and Orica GreenEdge became the first fully Australian backed and sponsored team to ride the Tour in 2012. And just to put that into context, I mean, I was looking back at their roster for that 2012 Tour, Daniel. Stuart O'Grady was part of that team, and you know, he's in his mid-50s now, and that gives us a kind of a sort of snapshot of the longevity of the team. It's been around a long while. It made a real impact very early on. Won Milan-San Remo with Simon Gerrans in the first year. Over subsequent years, they won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, also with Simon Gerrans. Paris-Roubaix, of course, with Matt Heyman in 2016. And they made a real splash in the 2013 Tour de France after a kind of quite a tricky debut at the Tour in 2012. They really upped their game in 2013. Gerrans, well, they got the bus stuck under the finish line in Corsica first, didn't they? Almost brought the entire Tour de France to a standstill when the finish line had been lowered to its correct height and the team bus hadn't got through into the team bus parking in time, and so it got stuck under there. But then Gerrans won a stage, wore the yellow jersey. Darrell Impey also wore the yellow jersey. And the team has been a real fixture and a sort of home of homes for some of the best Australian talent over the years. And so a real surprise that they would find themselves in the position where the I's weren't dotted and the T's weren't crossed. Now, the team is sponsored by Jayco. Jayco Australia is a company Gerry Ryan owns. He started out his kind of business empire in the world of caravans, motorhomes and recreational vehicles. And Jayco Australia has a huge market share of the Aussie market. And over the years, you know, clearly Gerry's companies, because the Mitchelton Winery is one of his other companies, Mitchelton were a title sponsor of the team. Jayco's currently a title sponsor of the team. And so a lot of the financial heavy lifting, I suspect, is being done by Gerry Ryan's companies. He's in his mid-70s now. And I think the search has been on over subsequent years to try and spread that financial load. Alula, which is a Saudi, investment vehicle, isn't it? It's are they looking to build significantly in parts of Saudi Arabia, aren't they?
Well, it's a tourist attraction. It's it's an ancient city that has been sort of reinvented, hasn't it? It's one of several of these sites in there's a city that's being built in Saudi Arabia as well, isn't there? Is it Neom City? And there's a heavy investment into art as well, and this is all supposedly purportedly in the name of diversifying Saudi Arabia's economy, which has been heavily based on oil, fossil fuels.
So there was this worrying period whereby the deadline was missed. Now technically that gave all of the Jayco Alula contracted riders, both I gather on the men's and the women's side, would have been free to negotiate contracts to go elsewhere. So they could have found a situation where they might have lost key riders. That hasn't happened. And our colleague Daniel Benson has a really good piece actually on his Substack, Daniel Benson's cycling Substack, in which he has interviewed Brent Copeland, who is the general manager of the team, having kind of taken over as the figurehead of that team, both in a sort of sporting context and also a sort of, you know, link between the team and the businesses that sponsor it. And he said that they came close-ish to having to pull down the shutters on the team. So clearly it went to the wire, but everything is in place. And in fact, in the last 24 hours or so, Michael Matthews has signed a 2-year contract with the team, extending his stay there. So we have to assume that all is well for the time being. But the kind of the longer term picture for a team that is established in the sport, it's been around for well over a decade, has won of welter, it's won multiple classics, it's got a marketplace all to its own in a way in being the Australian team. And yet there's always this sense that every year a big team somewhere or another will find that its foundations are slightly on quicksand.
Yeah, I have the feeling, and I've had the feeling for quite some time now, that the world, well, professional cycling is a bit of a bubble, and it's becoming a precarious bubble. Your budgets have absolutely soared. Our colleague from La Gazzetta dello Sport, Ciro Scognamia, reported a few, couple of months ago, I think it was, this was having seen the data produced by the UCI, the total budget for the World Tour. The World Tour didn't exist in 2002, but the equivalent of the World Tour, the total budget in 2002 was 150 million euros for all the top teams. Last year, 2024, it was 500 million. Average World Tour top level team in 2002, 5 million euros. Average now is 25 million euros. And you know, when teams do go under now, the bloodletting, if I can use that expression, is far greater than it used to be, in the sense that it was often in connection with doping, we would hear that a positive doping test would jeopardize a whole team's future, and it would jeopardize a certain number of jobs. And we used to hear that it would sort of jeopardize 40, 50, 60 jobs. Now, and we have a recent example of this with Arkea in France, you're talking about, with often there's a women's team involved, sometimes there's a development team involved, you're talking about 200 jobs. And you know, you do feel that some of these teams, particularly in the sort of second bottom half of the World Tour, are getting really, really stretched, because the return on investment is really not that great. The power is all concentrated in the hands and the legs, particularly of a few teams, and they're not getting that much bang for their buck. And we've had a period of relative stability in professional cycling where, okay, teams have gone bust or disappeared, but not as many as used to be the case. Lionel, this used to be an annual occurrence, didn't it? So the churn was kind of greater and more frequent then, but it seems to be more painful when it does happen now, particularly as regards the staff. And just the number, the proportion of people in an organisation that are part of the inverted commas backroom staff is much greater than it used to be. A professional cycling team used to be made up of the riders, three, four, five directors sportifs, a couple of masseurs, doctor, maybe a press officer, and it was pretty contained. Whereas now they are these sprawling organisations, and they are the ones, obviously, whose financial well-being is the most precarious when things go wrong. It's not the riders who have been cashing sort of, you know, half a million for 3 or 4 seasons.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned the sort of the average budget of a World Tour team being sort of 25 million euros. That's probably around about where Jayco Alula is. They're sort of mid-table, I would suggest, in terms of budget. But that average is heavily skewed by the real big spenders, especially UAE Team Emirates. I mean, the reports that their budget is north of 50 million a year. I mean, it's significantly uneven playing field, and they're all trying to compete across, you know, such a long, vast calendar of races that spans, well, pretty much 10 months now, doesn't it? And when you look at the confirmed roster for Team Jayco Alula, the men's team next year, I mean, it's only just over 20 riders at the moment. So there must be some riders to be confirmed, either as re-signing and extending their stay, or maybe they're looking to see what happens with, you know some other teams cutting riders at very late in the year. But here we are, early November, and there's a real sense that the planning for next year can't really get underway until all of the pieces of the jigsaw are in place. And when you look at the recruitment that Jayco Alulu have done, not just this winter but previously, you know, Paul Double, for example, really interesting signing, a kind of a sort of money ball signing last year, Daniel, to use your phrase. You know, he'd impressed to a degree at the Polti Kometa team in the next level down. And he's had a solid season, which ended on a real high, winning the Tour of Guangxi a couple of weeks ago. But you look at the riders that Jayco Alulu have picked up, just to mention a couple, Alessandro Covi, who is kind of a talent, a sort of one-day rider, really a sort of Giro stage winner type profile of rider, but surplus to requirements at UAE Team Emirates because they have so many riders that are better than him. And then Dries de Bont, who really was kind of, his career was very much sort of fizzling out a bit, wasn't it? Until he did a bit of a turn on the Finestre at the end of the Giro, perhaps putting himself in the shop window. Mm. The allegation was that he was trying to ride himself into a contract at EF Education Easy Post, which all parties kind of denied. But Dries de Bont, you know, 34 years of age, kind of surplus to requirements at Decathlon, but a rider that has been picked up, I would suggest, because in terms of budget, he fits the bill. And when you look at the sort of support for a rider like Ben O'Connor, who, you know, is capable of a top 10 in any of the Grand Tours and outsider for a podium on certainly the Giro and the Vuelta, if not the Tour, it's really hard, even with that amount of money available, to put a team together that can compete on all of those fronts.
Yeah.
Knowing what we know about this year, which is that Matt White potentially paid the price by losing his job on the eve of the Giro because of a pretty underwhelming spring. You look at the roster and think, well, they haven't got the riders to sort of really overcorrect that next year. A real tough game. And as you say, Daniel, this is a team that's kind of squarely sort of in the middle of the World Tour.
And I think it is, you know, the GC riders in the second tier sort of for mid-table teams and the sprinters in the mid-table teams are going to lose out because they're the riders who will ultimately be sacrificed. The domestiques in a lot of cases or lead out men. I mean, you talked about Ben O'Connor there, and I've seen quotes, I think it was in Daniel Benson's piece with Brent Copeland, where he talks about why they probably won't sign a sprinter next year, and it's also because it requires considerable investment around the sprinter. Another thing, Lionel, when we talk about budgets, we generally think about rider salaries, but when you think about how sort of bloated cycling is and some of these organizations are, and particularly their race programs are, and if you add in a women's team as well, I mean, the fuel budget for some of these World Tour teams is over €1 million a year. Then you add in, and we're talking about Brent Copeland and Jayco Alulu, and Brent told me at the Vuelta that they probably won't go to do as many altitude camps next year because there's huge cost involved in that as well. And everything that we regard as sort of sports science, R&D, you know, one team nutritionist told me at the Tour de France that the ketones, if a team was to be using ketones and they didn't have a sponsor, not all of the teams have ketone sponsors, some of them just choose to buy the ketones themselves, for a Tour de France would cost well over €10,000. Just for the eight riders at the Tour de France. So, you know, it all adds up, and this is where I feel as though the UCI needs to look at the calendar and look at how sustainable the calendar is when some of these teams are stretched across three different programs or three different places, five, six, if you add in women's teams as well, at a time. And I just think that if relative to the number of people who are interested in watching cycling in the world, in Europe, wherever, I just don't think it's sustainable.
Especially when at the other end of the spectrum, you've got Remco Evenepoel spending 15 hours in a wind tunnel in California, you know, testing to find another, you know, half a degree of improvement to his position. You know, there'll be teams and riders that don't have any hours in a wind tunnel in multiple seasons, you know. And you're right, it magnifies all of those differences across the training opportunities, the racing programs. You know, if you've got a smaller roster, even by three or four riders, that's spreading everybody more thinly, and that will catch people out eventually. And so when you look at the the situation with a team like Jayco Alula, and maybe biased because obviously, you know, sort of seen Jerry Ryan around for so long, his passion is so obvious when he's at the big races like the Tour de France. You know, he's kind of lived his dream sort of almost vicariously through his riders who, you know, he establishes quite special relationships with riders. Everybody on that team seemed to talk very fondly of him because of his passion for the sport. And here we are, he's a wealthy business person who's put in a lot of money, either directly or indirectly, over a long period of time. He's brought additional sponsors into cycling, and yet, you know, there doesn't seem to be an awful lot in the framework of professional cycling, how it's structured, to kind of give any sort of return. It's just a case of what now needs to be spent to keep a team on the road, and that amount of money is going up and those challenges are getting harder. And you know, the supply of Jerry Ryans and people like that, well, they're in short supply.
Yeah,
and they're going up against teams that are sponsored by nation states.
Yeah, and that number that I mentioned, the 200 people that a team employs, I mean, that's obviously, I'm certain that will have been a big emotional burden for Jerry Ryan himself at various points in the history of that team. There probably have been times where he has contemplated, you know, pulling out, having given that team fantastic service financially over a long period of time, but has probably had second thoughts because he realizes that 100 people will be out of a job if he does pull out, because there is no sort of second sponsor waiting in the wings ready to step up, or there hasn't been.
Yeah, and there's not teams, you know, fighting for World Tour licenses in quite the same way that perhaps there was a decade ago. Yes, there are teams at the next level down, but they're existing at the next level down often for budgetary reasons as well. They don't have the finances, the funding to step up and make that huge leap from perhaps doing one or two Grand Tours and a smattering of big classics, and then filling the rest of their roster and the rest of their year with stage races here and there. Making that step up to World Tour, where you're more or less obliged to compete on every front. I know there are exceptions, but more or less obliged to compete on every front. You know, doubling up for Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico in March, and then taking on all three Grand Tours potentially. It's not like there's a queue of people waiting to take on a World Tour license should one become available.
There certainly isn't a queue of companies willing to invest 15 million euros of their marketing budget even to become a sort of second sponsor, 10 million to become a second sponsor. There isn't even a queue of people willing to invest 5 million.
Yeah, and I think then we see this in Belgium, you know, which is really the heartland, you know, almost the opposite of Australia in a way. Australia is kind of one of the arrivists in World Tour cycling terms, a bit like Great Britain with Team Sky, now Ineos Grenadiers, of course. You know, the sort of the new arrivals who've created these teams with a kind of a modern outlook and a kind of global outlook. We've got the situation with Lotto and Intermarché, which the merger we gather is going ahead, but there's still so much uncertainty that a rider of Binyam Gamay's stature is here at the start of November and unable to say, on the record at least, what he's doing next season. There's bound to be teams interested in taking him on if he doesn't go with the Lotto Intermarché merger. But I think the wider picture here is that, you know, Lotto fell out of the World Tour and have won its way back into the World Tour with its performances on the road. Intermarché, always the Wallonian team. You know, we've always had a very strong presence in Flanders with Quickstep, Soudal Quickstep, and Lotto, of course. I mean, Lotto is sponsored by the Belgian National Lottery, but it's still a team which has a much more Flemish heartbeat than a Walloon heartbeat, I would suggest. Although, you know, over the years, it's had Philippe Gilbert on the roster, who's a Walloon, of course. Arnaud Delis, Walloon or Flemish?
He's Flemish. He's Walloon.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah. But we've got the situation where Belgium can't sustain a Walloon team on its own. The Intermarché team has spent more than it's earned. It's run up deficit by all accounts. And it's in a situation where the merger with the Lotto team is really the only way to kind of save spaces for some of the riders. And looking at the roster at the moment, again, lots to be confirmed, but it does look very Lotto heavy. The Antimarché riders don't appear to be sort of heading across into the new team in the numbers that you might expect. And that will mean that there'll be lots of riders available for teams to pick up, potentially slightly cheaper than they would if they were looking to sign them several months ago. But I do think it's extraordinary that Biniam Gamai is currently unsure where he's going to be riding, who he's going to be riding for next season.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you said there are opportunities, sort of market opportunities, and there are a few teams that have got spaces left. I think Movistar have got two. Movistar mainly only one spot left. I think Jayco have left two or three open, and there are a few other teams that have left two or three open. So it's kind of a buyer's market in the sense that the market is flooded. One thing I have heard from a couple of riders in the last few months, Lionel, is that, as we know, negotiations happen earlier and earlier in the year now, and often for the bigger riders, often before the Giro even. And what is becoming a bit of a common theme is riders getting offers or getting some vague offers early in the year and thinking, or their agents kind of persuading them, thinking that they can do better, and them going out into the market and finding that actually that's not the case, going back to the team that originally offered them something only to find that offer is no longer in place, and those riders are now struggling or have been struggling. So it's also a sort of landscape that's changing from the riders' point of view as well. And I don't envy some of those chaps who are still looking for jobs.
No, because there's a big gap for the Antimarché riders who don't currently have a deal to fall into, isn't there? Because when you look at the roster, other than Gamai, Louis Barré, Arne Marit, Lawrence Rex, Georg Zimmermann, Gerben Tyson, we know Louis Menkes is retiring. Yeah, beyond that, it's not as if people may be queuing up to sign a lot of those riders, and yet there's nowhere really for them to fall back into. The next level down, there is the Flanders Baloise team, but that's a Belgian team as well, but that has currently a pretty full roster for next year, the next level down. So this sort of existential crisis for World Tour teams does have real world consequences for riders who may well have to take a bit of a haircut for 2026.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with a Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Well, Lionel, we don't know in which teams certain riders will be competing in 2026, but we're starting to find out a little bit more about the geography of where some riders will be competing in 2026. A few things starting to leak out. I mean, one of the biggest sources of speculation is not where the Giro will go, but it's a perennial question now, is when the Giro presentation is going to take place, and which year is it going to take place in. That still seems to be shrouded in mystery. I think it's going to happen at the end of November, start of December. Last I heard, they were looking for a venue. They were looking for some sort of village hall or social club, British Legion Club in Turin, where to do it. But I think that is going to happen fairly imminently. Of course, we know the first three stages is going to be in Bulgaria. There's some, I don't think it's been confirmed, but there's some pretty sort of strong reporting about where those stages are going to go. Basically, the three-day stay, sojour in Bulgaria, is going to end in Sofia, and then the race caravan will fly to Calabria. So that's the sort of toe of Italy and make its way fairly swiftly, not linger too long in the south of Italy. It's going to revisit Napoli, which has become a bit of a theme in the last few days, midway through that first week, and then it's going to head up through the peninsula. On the mountain stages, it looks like the Alps and the Val d'Aosta, so the northwest of Italy at the end of week two mainly, and then into the Dolomites and Friuli in the last week. So there's going to be a stage finish probably to Madonna di Campiglia, which of course is infamous because of what happened there with Marco Pantani in 1999. We are going to see a big Dolomite tapone, queen stage in the Dolomites in the province of Belluno, 2 or 3 days from the end. And then quite an exciting, or certainly a very difficult looking penultimate day with a stage finish at Piancavallo, which is in Friuli. It's a ski resort. It's quite a wide road. The Giro has been there several times before. Pantani and Tonkov had a famous battle there in 1998. It was also scene of a key battle between Teo Gegenhardt and Jai Hindley in 2020. Quintana versus Dumoulin, I think that was 2017. But very difficult climb, and I think there are going to be two ascents of that on the penultimate day of the Giro. And then the Giro, yet again, is going to do its silly commute down to Rome. After a bit of speculation that it might go back to Milan, the race might actually visit Milan earlier on, but it's going to finish in Rome again.
Yeah, they're kind of piecing it together now, I guess, getting all the contracts signed, working out where it can go. I think, Daniel, you were talking about the potential for the Bulgaria Grande Partenza when we were in Albania back in May. Mm. And there's obviously, you know, Budapest, then Albania, and now Sofia, sort of Central European theme emerging here, isn't there? Is this a similar decision basically made on the basis that Sofia's keen, Bulgaria's keen, has the money and is willing to pay, and the Giro's happy to go?
Yeah, don't know too much about it at the moment, to be honest, Lionel. And there is less of the, with Albania and Italy, that was very much in the diplomatic relations between those two countries had been in the news for a year or so for various other reasons. And there was a real sort of a cozy relationship between the Albanian government and the Italian government. It didn't really translate into, well, any great, we expected when we went there, we might see more evidence of the sort of political motivation for the Grande Partenza, but really there wasn't too much of that when we were there. And in Bulgaria there is a bit less of that. I think it's more to do with Bulgaria promoting itself as a tourist destination to Italians and to the wider world. But yes, we shall see. We shall see in a few weeks, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say something here, Daniel. I don't know whether you agree or not, but I think I'm much more on board with a start in Bulgaria, a grand tour taking the sport to an area that is less well known for professional cycling, as with Albania, to a degree with Budapest in Hungary, certainly Jerusalem in Israel, and before that Belfast, and even when the Giro started in Herning in Denmark in 2012, I can get fully behind those kind of foreign starts. Where I'd find it a bit strange is with the Vuelta, starting in Turin this year, and next year, 2026, it's going to start in Monaco. Now, these to me, these are solidly Giro and Tour territory. And while I don't have too much objection with the Tour de France and even the Vuelta kind of slipping a little bit across the border, I'm a bit curious as to why the Vuelta in particular is, you know, targeting a start in Turin 1 year and then Monaco the next, when there's a whole of Spain to play with, or even Portugal, like with Lisbon a few years ago, a couple of years ago, wasn't it, 2024. And you know, that was great, but why go and start where there's already, you know, synonymous with one of the other grand tours? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I felt the same when the Vuelta started in Nîmes. It felt really strange, incongruous, kind of low-key compared to the Tour de France. It didn't really feel like the race was on home soil. It was, you know, I was just a bit discombobulated by it. And I think Monaco would be the same. We had a start there in the Tour de France in 2009, which was pretty spectacular, wasn't it, with the time trial that went on parts of the motor racing circuit and the marina there and the kind of the, you know, all of the things that Monaco can deliver aesthetically. You know, it's the playground of the rich and famous. And I don't know, the Vuelta's a little bit more kind of a farmer's market, or, you know, it's a Wednesday afternoon market. It's not really kind of you know, Rolex watches and casinos, is it?
I don't know, Lan. I'm just looking at the driving distance, 5 hours, 14, 49 minutes from Monte Carlo to the French-Spanish border. Incidentally, this might surprise some people, but Gary Verity, the gentleman who brought the Tour de France to Yorkshire, is very much involved with this Gran Salida from Monaco. Gary Verity has maintained a strong relationship with ASO and Christian Prudhomme, the boss of the Tour de France. And I actually chatted to Gary Verity about this start from Monaco at the start this year in Piemonte, and he did tell me some things about where the race was likely to go after that, but we currently don't have any information. We only know about the first stage time trial, which is going to take place entirely in Monaco and take in, not all of, is it, Lionel? I don't think it's not all of the Formula One circuit, it's some of it.
Yeah, I mean, presumably they'll make their way at least a little bit across the south of France and towards Spain and round the corner. But I don't know, I'm sounding perhaps a bit grumpy and old here. I mean, but I just think it would be more interesting for the Vuelta to start somewhere less kind of synonymous with one of the other Grand Tours. But I guess this is all part of the race to win Tadej Pogacar's heart, really, isn't it? Because Monaco, of course, is where Pogacar lives. The Giro d'Italia, very happy with the fact that Pogacar rode and dominated the Giro last year and would no doubt like him back. I mean, is it a case of one race waiting till the other has published its route to make it more Pog-friendly, to ensure that the Slovenian superstar is on the, or the Slovalian, as you called him a couple of weeks ago, is on the start line? I mean, it does feel like the sport is kind of bending its will to Pogacar in more ways than one at the moment. There's a kind of a real sense that he is the one that delivers all of the star quality, and if it were possible, every race in the world would do something to try and persuade him to take the start.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you sort of frame that against the sort of backdrop of what people are saying at the sort of grassroots level of, well, grassroots kind of fans, or people who would term themselves sort of diehard fans, who are talking about it being boring and Pogacar's dominance being a turn off. And certainly, as you say, Lionel, the sort of the message that's coming through pretty loud and clear at an administrative level is that Pogacar is really the only show, or the main show in town.
The thing is, Sebastian Piquet and you and I, Daniel, when we recorded our podcast a few weeks ago, Seb said something really interesting after we'd recorded, when we were perhaps, or certainly I was on that side of the fence, saying that this kind of this dominance and seeing the same thing repeatedly weekend after weekend starts to lose its interest for me in particular. But Seb made the point that I think sort of everyone wants to see Pogacar complete the set of five monuments by winning Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix. And at some point, he is going to have to ride the Vuelta and try and win that too, to complete the set of the three Grand Tours. I think there's only seven riders in history who've actually done that. So that's still a pretty elite club of riders. And Pogacar will want to be considered among that. The difficulty is, as ever, the proximity of the Giro to the Tour, and then the Tour to the Vuelta, and how he makes that fit in with all of the other things that he wants to do over the season. There's been lots of speculation about what Pogacar's programme will look like next year. Even some suggestions that he might do the Giro and Vuelta and skip the Tour de France I've seen floated around on the internet. I mean, I'm quite happy to be wrong about this, but I can't see that being the case at this point in Pogacar's career.
It would be interesting. That would mimic exactly what Eddie Merckx did after winning four Tours de France, which is the number that Pogacar has won. That was when he took his year out to win the Vuelta and do the Giro as well in 1973, and then came back to the Tour in 1974.
Yeah, but in the game of sort of cycling supermarket sweep, you want to make sure your trolley is full of all the most desirable items first. I can't see him skipping the Tour de France at this point. I mean, unless there was an enormous check on the table for UAE Team Emirates to make it happen. I don't think he can do all three Grand Tours. I think that would be a stretch in a single year. The question is, does he repeat his spring program, go back to Paris-Roubaix, try and win that in the spring, then give himself quite a light build-up to the Tour de France? There's a four-week gap between the end of the Tour and the start of the Vuelta. Having the start in Monaco means he can more or less roll out of bed and go and do the opening time trial and probably potentially stay at home even if he really wants to. I think that next year is complicated also by the fact that the European Road Race Championships are being held in Slovenia, in Ljubljana, the capital. Now, ordinarily, especially as he ticked that one off the list this year by winning the European Road Championships in France, it's not going to be high up his list of priorities for the race itself. But the fact that it's being held in his home country, I think, will be a draw for him. So I do think that the Vuelta at this stage looks a less likely than the Giro, simply because can he go Tour, Vuelta, and then into the World Championships in Montreal, which are the course for which he's going to suit him down to the ground, and then another week into the start of October with the Europeans in Slovenia. Now, if he wants to be at his best and try and win, that's quite a long block from the start of July to the start of October to maintain a high enough level to beat everybody else. So I think it's up in the air what he decides to do. He may leave the door open, but I don't know. That decision would be made if he said, I'm going to go and do the Giro, ride the Giro. That decision will be made for him, because I just can't see him skipping the Tour.
Yeah, I also think that he has now, will have accumulated enough knowledge about what he finds most wearisome, what he finds most tiring and stressful, in order to be very realistic about all of this now. I mean, we talked last spring, didn't we, about the fact that, okay, it wasn't many race days, but there were a lot of trips home. There were a lot of sort of every time you go to a classic, there's a build up, there's a sort of 2 day build up with press conferences and so on and so forth. So that adds a lot more mental stress than just the single day of racing. You can't really take those races as just one day of racing. You have to consider everything that goes around them. So you could look at it and say that, okay, maybe sacrifice, because this year he did the UE Tour, definitely sacrifice that. Maybe Strade Bianche, because that comes right at the beginning of March, and that's, is it 2 weeks or 3 weeks before Milan San Remo?
2 weeks.
2 weeks before Milan San Remo. So then you can sort of cut off 2 weeks there, and then you cut off another 2 weeks at the end of Paris-Roubaix. But then to do Paris-Roubaix and not do the Ardennes almost seems a nonsense when you consider the characteristics of Pogacar as a rider. He's very suited to the Ardennes, and you feel as though he could just turn up and win, and less obviously suited to Paris-Roubaix. But again, Lionel, if his sort of holy grail is winning these last races that are missing from his palmarès, then maybe that's an option. So you save sort of 4 weeks on the front end of the season, and then you really backload the season with two Grand Tours, all those things that you mentioned, the Worlds, the Vuelta, the Italian Classic, Lombardy, probably even again. So I think that's maybe an option. But then you also have to assess, does he need stage races, 1 week stage races to warm up? He'll know now, having done the UAE Tour a few times, what is the utility of that at that time of the year. The same with the Dauphiné. It may be that he feels that he can't realistically go to the Tour de France without having done a good solid, or a couple of 1 week stage races, particularly one in June beforehand. So it's a difficult circle to square. I mean, maybe he needs to think in terms of a 2 year plan rather than a 1 year plan. I don't know.
And against that backdrop, you've got a race at the E3 Saxo Classic, which is the only one of the major Flemish classics that's not organised by Flanders Classics. They have beefed up their course for next year's race, made it even harder with a second climb of the Alde Quanemont, and including two climbs of Karna Melk Beekstraat, trips off the tongue, making it a day of more than 3,000 metres of climbing. The E3 Saxo Classic is already a tough kind of mini Tour of Flanders. It packs a lot into a couple of hundred kilometres. And Pogacar was third there a couple of years ago. He was in really racing in the mix with the likes of Matthew van der Poel, Wout van Aert. And that move presumably has been designed to tempt Pogacar to ride the E3 Saxo Classic, which is on the Friday before the Tour of Flanders, not 2 days before, the previous Friday to that. And that in itself would extend that cobbled classics campaign by another week and a bit. And I suppose this is, you know, that's a decision for Pogacar and UAE Team Emirates to make. But it's interesting that even the organisers of the E3 Saxo Classic are choosing to change the character of their race to make it even harder in an era when we already know that a tough cobbled classics course is really only going to suit a very small handful of riders. And the harder you make it, the less likely it's going to be a kind of a all guns blazing spectacle. The more likely it's going to be a kind of a processional victory for one or the other of this handful of big stars. But I guess they're trying to lay the groundwork for, you know, a humdinger of a race as a kind of warm up for the Tour of Flanders. But do they need to do that? I'm not necessarily sure they do.
Yeah, I think if you ask most race organisers, most one-day race organisers, what their dream scenario for their event would be, and they would say a head-to-head battle between Tadej Pogacar and Mathieu van der Poel, maybe one other. And, you know, we said it after Milan-San Remo last year, didn't we? RCS couldn't have curated more of a sort of dream finale for... Well, the only way they could have would have been to give Filippo Ganna the victory. But I think that is what a lot of race organisers have in mind when they are probably thinking about their courses and their route design. Unfortunately, Lionel, is that enough about... Well, that was quite a lot of speculation, in fact.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah. Well, it's the end of the season where we can indulge in a bit of speculation at this point.
Should we have just a little bit of an update on a real story? It's not speculation, although I wish... Oyer Lascano probably wishes that it was mere speculation. But unfortunately, as we found out last week, for him, the UCI had announced that they were provisionally suspending him because of anomalies on his athlete biological passport. I discussed this at some length with Larry, the Motown Maestro, on Friday, and there have been some updates. There's been some good reporting on this by our colleague, legendary Spanish journalist Carlos Arribas of El País. And Carlos had some interesting information about how the investigation had progressed. He reported that in mid-April, agents from the ITA, so that's the agency that carries out dope testing on behalf of the UCI, and members of the Spanish Guardia Civil, their sort of drug squad, together, interesting, the ITA and the Guardia Civil, visited Lascano at his home in Andorra, and they asked to, well, the Guardia Civil, I would guess, were the ones who seized his laptop and mobile, or took them away for analysis. We also learned in Carlos's article at the weekend that the ITA, or the expert panel, whose findings have ultimately led to this provisional suspension, they had identified four anomalous values in Lascano's biological passport. We also found out, well, and that was in April, and then in May, so we thought that Lascano had been put on some sort of gardening leave because he disappeared from races. We didn't know what was happening. No one seemed to know where he was. We learned that Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe had actually suspended, maybe the wrong word, but they'd stopped fielding him in races and decided that they would no longer field him in races from May. And that was all, well, that all came before the announcement last week that there is a provisional suspension. And now, if Lascano doesn't accept the consequences, I talked about this in the podcast on Friday, at this stage in the proceedings, they basically present the rider with sort of sanctions, proposed sanctions, and if the rider doesn't accept that, then effectively it goes to the UCI tribunal, and that is where the final judgment will be made on the case. And that could, this stage could last months or even more than months. In the meantime, Rebel Bora Hansgrohe have confirmed that he will not be on the team next year, and Lascano himself has issued a statement proclaiming his innocence, saying that he's never taken any banned substances and he intends to fight this. Lionel, just a couple of things that have occurred to me in the last 3 or 4 days. One of our other friends, colleague and good friend of mine, Magnus Ora from Norwegian television, he was in contact with me about another Spanish case for a rider called Ibai Salas. Now, this was a few years ago, and Ibai Salas was his name, and he initially received a 4-year sanction for alleged irregularities in his athlete biological passport. He fought this in the court, and the Spanish High Court, the Spanish Supreme Court, finally decided, I think it was last year, that the biological passport was not, or abnormalities in a biological passport were not sufficient for him to be considered as having doped. But there's a crucial difference in this. This was a biological passport that a Spanish domestic biological passport. It's not the same biological passport that riders on the ADAM system in the UCI testing pool are subject to. And it also, this also referred to 2017-2018, and this was before the latest version of the Spanish anti-doping law was passed. And the latest version of the Spanish anti-doping law, anyway, it does accept the biological passport as evidence. Anyway, WADA certainly, because they set up the biological passport, they certainly consider abnormalities in the biological passport to be evidence of doping. So it's not that relevant, I don't think, to the Lascano case. That's my reading of it. And Lionel, the thing that really caught my eye in Carlos Arribas's report as well at the weekend, well, these 4 abnormalities. Now, that doesn't look good, because I talked on Friday with Larry about other cases. Franck Bonamoy, for example, Roman Kreuziger, who's, that case was dropped in 2015, but that was a whole different sort of kettle of fish, and I explained that. But usually, you know, there'll be a couple of values, and there have been cases in the past when a rider in the stage before the provisional suspension is passed down, there's sort of a back and forth between the rider and the expert panel. And riders in the past have been successful in explaining, whether it's because of altitude, illness or whatever, why one of their values was off. But if there are 4, that doesn't look good. 4 over 3 years. I should also mention that in Carlos's report, he noted that Lascano's coach, Leonardo Piepoli, former Italian rider, he's been on the Movistar staff for a while. Now, when people think of Leonardo Piepoli, some will inevitably think of him, he himself having been caught in 2008 for an EPO-like substance and banned. Is that relevant here? I'm not sure, really. There are a lot of people in the sport over the last few years who would vouch for Leonardo Piepoli having being a bit of a reformed character, being a good coach. So I'm not necessarily sure that that's relevant. Also, there was a cursory reference in Carlos's piece to links in Extremadura, and that's the region of Spain, it's on the border of Portugal, which was very much sort of where an investigation a couple of years ago into the Dr. Marcos Maynard, the investigation that involved Superman Lopez and eventually led to Superman Lopez getting banned. They were very much part of this investigation, and Carlos sort of suggested, Lascano, he started his pro career at Caja Rural, they were also named in this investigation, and he sort of suggested that there might be a link there, and that made me wonder about the Guardia Civil taking his laptop, taking his phones. Do they have some other kind of evidence? But that is speculation.
So we'll wait and see on that one.
We will wait and see. But it's a unsavory business line. I found myself reacquainting myself. This was the sort of thing, this was the kind of work and sort of reading and researching and trying to gen up on this kind of thing that we used to do on a very regular basis. Yeah. And I felt very rusty doing, because a lot of this stuff has become quite unfamiliar. Mm. Whereas once upon a time, 10, 15 years ago, you know, your contact book would be full of people working in anti-doping, experts, legal experts, so on and so forth. And we haven't really had to sort of dirty our hands with this kind of thing over the last decade or so, and very often anyway.
No, that's right. What else from the sort of the newsette? We've kind of delved quite deep into it today, haven't we? Have any other little snippets? A couple of things that have caught my eye over the last week or so. Sam Bennett, he has got a year's contract with Q36.5 after a season with Decathlon AG2R Le Mondial this last couple of seasons. I read some quotes. I think the article was from our colleague Shane Stokes, a piece about Sam Bennett, Irish rider, of course, and him kind of realizing when he was putting his race numbers on for the Tour de Vendée in the middle of October, and thinking to himself, this could be the last time I get to do this, pinning on race numbers. He is going to Q36.5, reunited with Kurt Bogerts, who was the sports director way back at the other end of his career at the Anpost Sean Kelly team for a couple of years there, before he then made his way to NetApp Enduro, I think it was, and then Bora Hansgrohe, and then to Koenig Quickstep, where arguably he had his sort of finest hours winning those stages of the Tour de France and the green jersey in 2020, the lockdown tour. I remember him winning the stage at Ile de Ré was a real kind of breakthrough moment for him. And then, of course, he won on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Another Irishman, the current Irish champion, Rory Townsend, who won the race in Hamburg, the World Tour race in Hamburg, holding off the entire peloton. This kind of got lost in the wash in the build-up to the Vuelta, didn't it, really? But it was an incredible race that he was part of the break, and he held on, even though the bunch sprint was kind of happening almost around him, but he held on to win the race, and he is moving to Unibet Rose Rockets, as they will be known from next season. And one other little thing that caught my eye is that the Challenge Mallorca, a race that I went to back in January and developed a bit of an affinity for, not least because I got to spend a bit of time with a very good friend, Rob Hatch. He wowed me with his pizza oven and his air fryer, my brief visit to Soyer there. They're going to have a team time trial race as part of the Challenge Mallorca. Now, I didn't wonder what's the point, but having seen one of the stages...
I can't believe that you've decided to... This is like, for a man who railed for years against the Tour Down Under, or suggesting the Tour Down Under was the charity shield, this is like the pre-match kickabout before a pre-season friendly.
Oh, I mean, harsh but true. Obviously, the tongue was very firmly in the side of my cheek whenever I made any of those comments about the Tour Down Under. It's the true start of the season. Yeah, the Challenge Mallorca, I do wonder, though, they had the issue with the stage that had to be cancelled because the course was not safe, and so it was a bit of a funny race this year. It did strike me that a team time trial, it's an awful lot easier to close the roads off for a shorter distance, you know, whatever it might have to be, sort of 20, 25 kilometres for a team time trial. But also giving the World Tour teams the opportunity to have a competitive go in that discipline with the Tour de France.
Do you think Pogacar's going to ride? Do you think UAE are going to come with their A team?
This is their big gambit. UAE are going to take the A team to Mallorca in January.
Vingegaard versus Pogacar in Mallorca on January the 21st.
It does highlight the difference between the haves and the have-nots, because I'm sure there'll be smaller teams thinking, are we going to go take all the time trial bikes as well? I mean, I know that lots of teams will be training in Mallorca at that time of year as well, but logistically pretty challenging, I would have thought, to have, what, four road stages and then a team time trial stage, unless they do something funky like make it a team time trial on road bikes. But we shall see. It's something to keep an eye on in January, and you'll be eating your words when Pogacar and UAE Team Emirates thrash Visma Lisa bikes, Vingegaard and
they
all
turn up, in they turn up with the heavy artillery. They charter five ferries and come with six team buses. Yeah.
Well, we'll see, won't we? Just very lastly, Daniel, a few high profile cycling books out recently. Have you read any of them? Bradley Wiggins, the
I read a few pages of the Bradley Wiggins one the other day. Interesting stuff. A lot of, I wouldn't say speculation, but quite a few things teased in that, Lionel. You know, sort of teasing stuff that may yet come out in the future still.
Regarding the Jiffy bag.
Team Sky.
And yeah. Team Sky, yeah. I'm looking forward to reading that one. Geraint Thomas as well. He has retired this winter and his latest autobiography is out. And it's called According to G. And Daniel, have you read any of Mark Cavendish's latest book?
I've got a copy, that's a relief.
I hope you did read it.
Now there's been a bit of beef about that, Lionel. There's been a bit of beef about the Cavendish book. I don't know if you've seen this, between him and
Patrick Lefevre. Surprise, because Patrick Lefevre lives in a world where his version of events cannot be contradicted by anybody else. I would suggest that in the world of Patrick Lefevre, he absolutely believes what he's saying, but I would have thought Mark Cavendish would absolutely believe what he's saying as well, and perhaps a little bit got lost in sort of contract negotiation translation, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of blew up at the end of last week, I think, on Friday. I think Patrick Lefevre still has his column on Friday in Het Nieuwsblad. I don't know if this is the case, but I am fairly confident that there will have been a discussion between Cavendish and Patrick Lefevre since then. Hopefully, they've sort of cleared the air. But yeah, this was about the negotiations which took place after 2021. So of course Cavendish had his fantastic Tour de France, won four stages in 2021. This was after Lefevre, certainly how Lefevre saw it, he'd given Cavendish a lifeline. But then when Cavendish went to sign on for the next year, there were long delays in terms of, well, the contract being ready to sign, and there was a bit of a sort of tug of war. And I think their sort of recollections of events do differ slightly, but more than that, it's the sort of symbolism, or the meaning of how they each behaved, I think, has aggrieved the other party. So anyway,
yeah, it's interesting that I was thinking back to that tour in 2021, where of course Cavendish drew level. Did he? Level, didn't he? The 34th stage win was in Carcassonne. I was there. I wasn't on the whole tour that year. But the following morning at the start in Carcassonne, I went to speak to Patrick Lefevre. And I was really, at the time, quite surprised that his demeanour was that Cavendish should go to the Champs-Élysées, the end of the tour, win the 35th stage and then, you know, retire as the greatest of all time, and that he should draw a line under his career. And I was like, well, if he doesn't win that, do you not want to take him on for another year? And Lefevre was very much of the kind of, look, it's business, it's not personal, you know. Yeah. And I think he'd made his mind up at that point that he wasn't going to extend for another year. There's also the detail I gather in the book, Daniel, not read it yet, but we'll get round to it, about the point at which Cavendish pitched a return to Ineos Grenadiers, having ridden, of course, one season only with Team Sky in 2012, of course, wasn't it? Because he was led out onto the Champs-Élysées by Bradley Wiggins as he won the tour. Cavendish, of course, in the rainbow jersey there, and pitched a return to Ineos Grenadiers, put quite a lot of work into a sort of PowerPoint presentation, which I'm assuming would have covered all of the, you know, on-bike, off-bike, commercial opportunities, you know, other things that he could bring to the team. Put a lot of work into it, presented it to Dave Brailsford, and Dave Brailsford took a few days before not really replying, getting Rod Ellingworth to give the thumbs down. Interesting. Yeah, yeah. But all of that is in the book, Daniel. I won't spoil it any further. But those three books, I think, are all available now.
They are. Lionel, we'll be back next week at some point.
Indeed. Well, good luck on your running race on the weekend.
The house cross country. Have you, yeah, okay.
Is there anywhere we can watch your dot or anything like that? Is it that sophisticated?
No. You can. You'll probably be able to pick me out on the drone footage that will go out later that day. If I
well, update everyone on Instagram how you get on.
I would.
Good. Thanks, Mike. Good luck.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.